crime content enthusiasts, tap in. I have to tell you about June's Journey, the captivating hidden object mystery game that'll transport you back to the glamour of the 1920s. Step into the shoes of June Parker, a daring young detective on a quest to uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of her sister. With each scene explored, you'll unravel a collection of dazzling hidden object spectacles, leading you closer to the truth. Engage your sense of observation as you scour through the beautifully detailed scenes from the parlors of New York to the sidewalks of Paris in search of hidden clues and mind-teasing mysteries. But June's Journey isn't just about solving crimes. It's about escaping reality and immersing yourself in a world of mystery, danger, and romance. Customize your very own luxurious estate island. Decorate it to your heart's content and join a detective club to chat and play with other players. My personal favorite time to play June's Journey is when I'm waiting for my daughter after school in the carpool line. It's my little slice of me time on the weekdays. Although I love a good mystery, my favorite part of the game is being able to play with others. If you're craving a good mystery, looking for an escape, or some me time, why not travel back in time to the glamorous 1920s and channel your inner detective? Dive into June's captivating quest today and see if you can crack the case. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Lawn Kings, headquartered in Los Angeles, California, is a synthetic grass company specializing in front and backyard transformations. Lawn Kings sells and expertly installs synthetic grass for homes, commercial buildings, sports fields, and theme parks in the Southern California area. Lawn Kings has perfected their craft over the last decade, and the majority of their business comes by way of referrals from happy customers. Lawn Kings synthetic grass is safe for kids and pets and can dramatically reduce your water bill. The grass is very low maintenance and comes with a long-term warranty. If you'd like a free estimate, head over to lawnkingsinc.com and tell them Jamie from Murderish sent you. I know the owner on a first-name basis because, well, he's my husband. My husband, Steve, has owned and operated Lawn Kings for the last 10 years, and he's a licensed contractor. He got his start in the business building outdoor sets for the movie industry for almost 20 years. He really knows his stuff, and he's kind of a nice guy. So head over to lawnkingsinc.com if you'd like more information or a free estimate in the Los Angeles or surrounding areas. Hey everyone, it's Jamie. Thanks so much for joining me on another episode of Murderish. Today you're in for a real treat, but before I get into those details, I want to discuss a recent bit of exciting news. It was recently announced that the Dirty John podcast is being turned into a TV show on Bravo Channel. If you haven't heard the episodes already, I interviewed some of the ladies involved in the Dirty John saga. Take a listen to those episodes if you haven't already. I am so excited about the Dirty John story being turned into a TV show, and I'll be waiting very impatiently for the show to air. I'm hearing that taping will begin sometime this summer. Connie Britton will star in the TV show and play the role of Deborah Newell, who was Dirty John's last love interest and victim before he died. I'm very curious to see who will play the role of Dirty John in the show. Tara Newell mentioned that she and her mom would like to see the actor John Hamm play the role of Dirty John. I think that would be spot on. Other people in the Murderish Facebook group have suggested Chris Noth, Mr. Big from Sex and the City, or Alex Baldwin. Whoever they choose, I'm sure the show will be a big hit because people, including me, are fascinated with the story as it's a real-life true crime that was absolutely made for TV. So, about today's episode. Recently, an opportunity for a great interview came my way thanks to my friend Carrie Martin, who co-hosts the White Wine True Crime podcast. Carrie has been so supportive, and she seems to act as sort of a connector for many people, including me. So a big thank you to Carrie for making this interview possible. Okay, so you're probably wondering who I'm interviewing in this episode. For those of you who are fans of the TV channel Investigation Discovery, you may have heard of a show called Murder Chose Me. Murder Chose Me is hosted and narrated by Rod Demery, a retired homicide detective who now works as a special investigator for the district attorney's office in Shreveport, Louisiana. Rod has lived a very fascinating life and is no stranger to tragedy. When he was just 3 years old, Rod's mother was murdered. Rod never really got the true story of what happened to his mother, so in his 20s, he took matters into his own hands and ultimately solved the case of his mother's murder. Through the process, Rod had the opportunity to interrogate his mother's murderer face to face. Can you even imagine what that experience was like for him? We discuss it in depth during the interview you're about to hear. When Rod was a young adult, murder came back into his life and resulted in his own brother being convicted and sentenced to life in prison for murdering someone. Rod also opened up about that incident and how it impacted him. Rod and I discuss everything from what makes a killer, to whether OJ did it, to some of Rod's most memorable cases working as a homicide detective. I think you're really going to enjoy the interview with Rod. I do want to offer an apology for misstating an important acronym during the interview. Rod and I talked about the reasons why cases involving minorities, such as the LGBTQ+ community, aren't publicized to the magnitude of cases like the JonBenet Ramsey case, for example. When the topic came up, I misstated the LGBTQ+ acronym, and I'm so sorry about that. The LGBTQ+ community is near and dear to my heart, and I think it's important to use proper terminology when discussing this community. Okay, I think it's time to get on with the show. I hope you enjoy my interview with Rod Demery of Murder Chose Me on Investigation Discovery. So, Rod, you've obviously spent a lot of years in, violent crime unit as a homicide detective. You retired in 2016. And so now you work now as a special homicide investigator for the district attorney's office.
Right.
With all that as well, you also are the star of a show called Murder Chose Me on Investigation Discovery.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot, doesn't it?
I think it is a lot. The true crime genre has become so popular. Mm-hmm. People binge on, all the TV shows, the podcasts, the documentaries. And I'm one of those people, too. I'm one of those true crime obsessed people that, I was one of those weirdos as a kid that was reading books on serial killers, as a teenager. Yeah. And my mom's like, I think something might be wrong with my daughter. And I'm like, no, it's just fascinating. Because for me, I like to get into, I'm fascinated by the psyche of a killer, because they're just so different from the average human being.
Right.
What makes their brains different? I don't know. But it's very fascinating. So I have some questions surrounding that. But wanted to thank you for being here today, first of all.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, me too. So I'd also read in my research that you are a Navy veteran as well. Yeah. Thank you so much for your service.
Thank you.
You got a very impressive background.
Yesterday was the 27th anniversary that we got back from Desert Storm.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was just coming back and forth on social media with some guys that I was in the Navy with.
I would imagine those are some deep-rooted friendships, what you all went through together.
Yeah, definitely.
So, well, thank you for your service.
Thank you.
So, I know you experienced significant tragedy during your childhood, and that, I believe, ultimately led you into a career in criminal justice. Can you tell me a little bit about your childhood and where you grew up?
Yeah, my mother was killed when I was three, and my family is originally from a place called Natchitoches Parish in Louisiana. Yeah, it's a little small, typical Louisiana town. In fact, Still Magnolias was filmed there,
so
it's a really charming little place. After my mother was killed, my grandparents moved my brother and I to New Mexico, and I grew up in New Mexico. So I didn't have a whole lot of memories of Louisiana, except for the times we came back and forth for little vacations. But so I grew up in New Mexico, and that's a different environment. I didn't know a lot about Louisiana or Louisiana culture other than what my grandparents told me. But New Mexico was it, and I spent most of my summers in L.A. So growing up there, it's kind of a different feel. It's a place that it's not like the South or even New York or LA. It's big melting pot. You have all these people that come in, most from the military, so you have all kinds of different cultures. And it's now that I in retrospect, I had a pretty fortunate environment where I grew up.
That's good to hear.
Because
that's not an easy situation.
So
when you were 3 years old, your mother moved away in search of a new life. What were the issues at the time that she was trying to escape? Why was she in search of a new life?
I think in Natchitoches Parish, it was still very rural country. Mm-hmm. And I think she was probably attracted to something bigger and better. So she got married, and the guy that she married moved her down to Texas. It's pretty close to Houston. Mm-hmm. It was on the Gulf Coast down there. So I think maybe she thought that, like most people, get away and see the world, I guess, and, eventually she was supposed to come back for my brother and I. She lived down there with him for just a a little while. I think I was a year old when they got married. There were some serious issues of domestic abuse, which I didn't find out until later. But it was quite a bit older than her, and I think that kind of played a part. And she, my mother was, she was not a passive person from what I know, and he was a pretty controlling guy. And I think it just escalated. And most, and you know, it's typical of domestic violence. You know, it's usually a man that can't control a woman's thoughts, or he's intimidated by a woman's intelligence or independence. It usually turns to violence. I mean, what else can they do besides physically dominate him? So that whole situation blew up, and eventually she decided she was going to leave him. And as she did, he shot her. And he, you know, I didn't know a lot about it at the time. You know, my grandparents were pretty sheltering. You know, heard bits and pieces about, you know, some believe he did it purposely, and, you know, he had told the police that it was an accident. He never went to jail. So, yeah, it was kind of a vague thing in my mind. But as I got older, obviously, I looked into it and actually investigated, and I found out all the details of it. And it was just as I thought. Domestic violence. He shot her 9 times in the back as she was trying to leave, and, you know, went to the police, and they let him go. So, you know, it's a, but, you know, if you go back to that time, you know, 1969, you know, so, you know, the women's rights movement had just started, and obviously the equal rights for, or civil rights for black people was just getting kicked off. So, you know, I don't know that they had a whole lot of value for that kind of life or an investigation of that, of a murder like that. Ironically, I called before I went to Texas to start the investigation, and one of the ladies that worked there, for the court, she told me that she, I mean, she's very blunt. You know, she said, you know, it's 1969, you know, women didn't have a whole lot of rights, and your mother was black, and nobody really, you know, did a lot in those days. So it was pretty interesting to pull the court records and listen to the attitudes and the tone. And yeah, so it was something that you, you know, you can hear about, but you really don't know until you get into it.
Very true. Yeah. It's sad to say, but yeah, we have, I like to think we've come a long way.
We have, actually.
Yeah,
quite a long ways. But, you know, we still have those issues. And, you know, it's a big part of violent crime, actually, is domestic violence. And, you know, it's always something that I've always worked with on the side. So it's a pretty big deal.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that. I was a, I served as a juror on a first-degree murder trial last year up in Santa Clarita, where I live, here in L.A. County. And it was the exact scenario you just painted, domestic violence. And it escalated very quickly. They were only knew each other for 5 months, got married in between that time, much older man, very controlling. And it was interesting because, you know, several of his previous girlfriends testified at the trial, but they were very submissive. And interestingly enough, they survived. The one who was not submissive, she was a very spicy kind of girl, right. Give it right back to you. And that's exactly what happened. And it escalated and he just couldn't handle it. And he killed her.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's a very familiar story. I think probably all of those cases, the basis of them or the major elements are going to be identical.
Yeah. Yeah. It happens far too often. That's for sure. So later in life, in your adulthood, you began seeking the truth about your mother's murder. What prompted your search for the truth, and how'd you begin that process?
You know, I don't know. It just, I had always had that curiosity, and I always wanted to know, but I just did it one day. You know, I was working as a burglary detective, and I knew where the place was, so I drove down to the little city and started pulling records. I got the autopsy report, the police reports, and there were a few people that were still around that were there when it happened, did some interviews. And I went back to Shreveport and located the guy who actually did it. He was in the hospital, had heart attack, quadruple bypass or something. I don't know. But I videotaped him at that time and kind of interrogated him, I guess. And just wanted to get the story from him, you know, to look at him, have him look at me and explain to me. And, you know, he did. And, well, he explained his original story. I don't think I expected him ever to just tell the truth. I didn't think that was possible. So I got all the details and, you know, and confirmed it. You know, ironically, it's just like a regular homicide investigation. You know, you just kind of go through it and you feel better, I guess, after you know what happened.
Sure.
And, you know, it's pretty interesting, you know, when I talk to younger homicide detectives, especially, you know, ones that I had trained. It's, you know, your job is really not to find somebody and punish them for what they did. Mm-hmm. It's just to find out what happened. You know, in retrospect, I think it's probably the unknown that really bothers people, you know, not really knowing what happened.
Oh, you know,
is this person free or, you know, and I think once you answer those questions, you know, you just kind of let it go from there, you know, eventually or hopefully it gets dealt with. I think the other part of it is that it gives a lot of people hope where they didn't have it, you know, because, you know, a murder happens 10 years ago and there hadn't been any closure, then the family's probably still under duress or some sort of stress. But I found out the truth 40 years later. So there's always that light at the end of the tunnel. May not come when you want it, but it eventually comes around.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you got that, because I can't even imagine, you know, the tragedy like that happening and that probably that burning feeling inside of you, knowing that you were never really given the truth.
Right.
And you also wanted probably justice for your mother.
Oh, yeah.
So it sounds like this man was fairly truthful with you.
He was.
He told you what happened.
Mm-hmm. He did. He told me that he and my mother were together. And I mean, he admitted some of the parts of it that were pretty controlling. You know, he talked about how he didn't like for her to go out and, you know, she would come back in late or stay out all night or something like that. So, you know, that undertone was there. It was pretty clear. He cried and, you know, he got emotional at times. And, it was totally not authentic. But, you know, I think I wasn't really looking for that. I didn't expect it from him, I guess. It's just a matter of just getting the answers for myself. You know, I don't know. I can't say that I felt one way or the other afterwards. Mm-hmm. But I guess maybe it was just better to know.
Yeah.
You know, kind of put that stuff to rest.
Oh, definitely. I can imagine. Yeah. And so there was nothing that could have been done from a legal standpoint. You said he never got convicted or charged.
No, he didn't. In fact, he was charged with what's called, I guess back in that day, murder without malice, which is, you know, kind of akin to maybe a manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did it, but I didn't mean to do it kind of thing. But at that point, you know, he was in his 70s and he was broken out of pathetic and, you know, his heart failed. I mean, you know, literally and figuratively. And I think probably after that interview, maybe, you know, not long after that, he died. So, you know, I don't know, maybe he was just hanging around long enough for me to find out what happened. So
I'm so glad he did, because I'm sure you are. I mean, it just, you know, at least you got those answers and things, I guess, happen the way they're supposed to.
Yeah.
But you definitely, you got some answers and that's what you were in search of.
So
that's great. So, and I won't harp on this anymore, but I did have some, you know, still some more questions surrounding that, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind.
Because I'm fascinated by this kind of stuff too. So I think I'd read somewhere that there may have been a police cover up in your mom's case, or do you still believe there was some sort of?
Well, you know, it's always a big question whether there's a cover up or just gross incompetence. And sometimes there's a little of both. I did a domestic violence seminar not too long ago back in Shreveport. And there was a lady that was explaining what she believed was a cover up. How a victim can go to the police or to their priest or to whomever, and everybody kind of pushes it aside.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my response or my comment to that is because a lot of people beat their wives and their girlfriends. So it's a cultural thing rather than a, you know, a legal issue, because it's kind of unreasonable to think that somebody or a prosecutor or a judge or a police officer that lives that type of lifestyle or believes that type of philosophy would, you know, have any real concern for a victim. So I think that's where the problem comes in. And back then, I think it was pretty much the same thing. You know, this guy had a pretty good standing in the community. You know, he was a hardworking guy. He was in oil and gas. And, you know, and it was kind of one of those cultures. And I don't know that part of it's cover up, because they don't really care to get it out. The other part is, you know, they kind of condone it. And, you know, so there are a lot of different reasons. But I think as of late, you know, it's starting to get a little better, you know, for domestic violence victims where it was before. No one really.
Yeah. And it sounds like, you know, in the case of your mother, especially back in that time, and I think, unfortunately, this still happens today. There's a lot of victim blaming. So
when you
said something that just struck a chord with me earlier, when you said, you know, he was mad about my mom staying out late, you know, I can just imagine in my head, because I think people still do it today.
They say,
what's a woman doing staying out so late?
Mm-hmm.
She needs to be in front of the stove cooking and she needs to be home for her man. And especially back then. So but I still think that people do that today. Women have a certain, it's like people expect women to be a certain way. And if you're not, it's very easy for people to victim blame, and it's really sad.
It happens a lot. It is. Unfortunately, you're right. That happens a lot. And, you know, one of the bigger questions, why didn't she just leave? Well, it's kind of a silly question, but people still ask that question. And I think that's just education. You know, I don't know that people are really, really well educated or well versed on how it works and the dynamics of it. And partly because it is part of a culture, you know, kids grow up seeing it, you know, and to a certain extent, it's almost accepted.
Yeah.
So it's just starting to change. And, you know, I would say in the last 5 or 6 years, really.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
and if you're somebody who's got some sort of notoriety, I mean, gosh, I hate to bring it up, but like O.J. Simpson, you know, like, you know, he's a hero. And he was in people's minds, and nobody wants to believe that. Probably so much easier to just kind of brush it under the rug and say, no, you know, O.J. wouldn't do that, and, you know, not our O.J.
Yeah, people don't want to believe it.
They don't want to believe it, but I do agree with you that I think a lot of that still goes on today. I mean, gosh, politicians, movie stars, all kinds of people.
It's a control and power thing. Not a lot has changed since 68. It's just a different way of doing it, I guess.
I guess it's
gotten a little better, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's got to be a pretty tough environment to be in.
Definitely. Yeah, I'm sure we still have a long ways to go on that. Yeah. Who do you think your mother would be today?
Yeah, you know, that's probably one of the biggest questions I've ever had.
Yeah.
And I never really thought about it. And I wonder what it would be like, you know, because, she'd probably be 72. You know, from what I knew about my mother, she was really smart, you know, and, you know, she was a pianist, and, you know, she was really, really smart. I recently found someone watched the show in Natchitoches Parish, and I went and did a parade in the little hometown where she was. And there was this guy that was waving in the crowd, and he gave me her school records. And,
That's so cool.
You know, that was pretty amazing because, you know, she had these handwritten autobiographies and, you know, she was in eighth grade at the time. And she talked about how she wanted to be a nurse and, you know, how she loved New Mexico when she went to go visit and come back to Louisiana, how different it was. And it was pretty amazing. So I think she would probably definitely be in service industries, whether it be a nurse or something like that. I think that was her nature.
A nurturer.
Oh, yeah. And she said she hated math, but she had really good grades in math. So yeah,
it's kind of funny.
I saw some similarities because I hate math.
How funny. So you're a lot like your mom that way. Yeah, but what a cool gift for you to receive that you just fell into your lap.
Yeah. It was pretty cool.
And it's all handwritten. That's so cool.
Yeah. So, and, you know, it's, I talked to my brother a while back when the show first started. And, you know, it's like, wow, you know, everybody's talking about you on television. So I said, well, dude, you know, it only meant one thing, really. You know, and I told him, you know, in 1969, no one really cared about her murder. You know, so everybody in the world knows her name. So it's that this whole immortalizing thing that turned out to be pretty cool.
I hadn't thought about that. You're right. Through you know, your success and the success of the show, everybody knows your mom's name. And that's a cool thing. Like, what would she think about all this?
You know, and it actually leapfrogs because there are so many victims that in the cases that we show now, you know, there were kids that were murdered or youngsters that were murdered that, you know, I call them kids because I'm getting older, but, you know, inner city kids or someone that nobody really knew a whole lot about or even cared for that matter. And, you know, it's kind of cool to get a letter from somebody or a message from somebody.
Yeah.
You know,
I'll ask you too, because I've wondered about this. Some of my other podcast friends, they have podcasts that are focused more on like lesser known cases and things like that. And unfortunately, a lot of the LGBTQ community, black community, things like that. Why aren't those cases as popular?
Well, you know,
like JonBenet Ramsey and
We have a very judgmental society.
Yeah.
And I think this season actually coming up, you'll see a story of a murder of a LGBT community, how that entire community was victimized. And it kind of shows how that stuff happens. You know, it doesn't go into great detail, but it's precisely that. You know, you have so many different attitudes that people have towards people for whatever reason. You know, I don't know. I can't really say what a civilian or independent citizen thinks because they have a right to feel and think. But as a police officer or, someone in the system that's supposed to protect everybody, then you don't really get the luxury of having that type of attitude. And if you do, you're in the wrong line of business. So.
Absolutely. So during your investigation, just, you know, as a homicide detective, at what point do you make an arrest? What do you need in order to make an arrest?
I think you have to, for me, I was never comfortable until I got a confession. But I think if you have enough evidence to kind of show that somebody had the means, opportunity, and, you know, it always helps to have a good witness and some physical evidence. But for me, it was, I had to have a story, you know, and, you know, someone couldn't just come in and say, you know, hey, I shot this person. No, they got to tell me how many times, you know, what'd you do with the gun? You know, I want to get intimate details because that's important, you know, because there's always going to be a question. And if you go back to the OJ case, I mean, they had mountains of physical evidence, but that it missed that personal story from somebody that can actually tell the story. And, you know, that can be that that confession or that statement can come from the suspect, which I always preferred. But if someone was there, it's even, you know, just effective. But I guess to arrest someone, it doesn't really take a whole lot, to be quite honest with you. Whether or not it makes it through the system is another thing. But for me, that was the point. I had to have somebody that could give me a good, credible story of what happened. And, you know, it's just gumshoe detective work. You know, nowadays everybody's looking for some sort of CSI magic.
But
but, you know, the reality is if you have a gun and, you know, it's the murder weapon. Okay, you got a gun, but did you pull the trigger? You know, so how do you get that extra bit? And I think removing all doubt, and I know it's a reasonable doubt standard, but I think removing all doubt is probably the best way to go. It's, you know, it's not always going to happen, obviously, but yeah, the closer you can get to it, the better.
So you achieved a strikingly high success rate with regard to confessions in solving cases as a whole. What was your strategy and why did it work so well?
It kind of sounds so trite when I say it, but it's true. You know, I really believe that that was my calling. You know, I don't think that I have any special skills or, you know, better than the next detective. It's just that, you know, I think that's what I was prepared to do. I mean, I could actually relate to the person who was mourning the death of somebody and someone who actually did it. And I mean, they're people, you know, it's just bringing that human element to it. And I think that makes the difference. And the other thing is I was totally obsessed with it. I mean, I couldn't do anything except that. And, you know, I say often it made me a good detective, but a bad friend or, you know, a husband or whatever, you know, it didn't work. But for that, I was really good because that's all I did. You know, it's a singular obsession. And I don't know that you could actually do that job and not feel that way, to be honest with you. It's kind of hard to think about, you know, birthday dinners or holidays or kids' soccer games when you just told this person that their kid was dead. So it's, I think you got to be cut from a special, you know, kind of call who you can suspend everything else in life.
And, yes.
Thinking that, you know, days off, vacations or anything like that, then you probably got the wrong job.
Yeah, that, it's interesting you say that because that was one of my questions is that, you know, you probably have to be, you're married to your job.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so there's got to be, unfortunately, you know, negative effects that spill over into your personal relationships. Yeah. I can't imagine how you could successfully do both.
I don't think you can.
Probably
I think,
so tough.
You know, and it was, I mean, but you make that decision at that moment, you know, it's like you're standing on a crime scene and, or going to a crime scene, your phone rings and you know that the other person on the other end, especially if you're married, is going to be really upset. But yeah, you don't care. You know, you either push that delete, reject button and just keep going.
You've got that singular focus and then I'm sure you've got a connection with the family members and you're just trying to try really hard to bring them justice and bring them answers. And so, that's that job is definitely not for everyone. We were talking about that before you got here. What's been one of your most frustrating cases and why?
I think the cases that were always most frustrating were the kids with juveniles. I mean, younger kids, you know, babies and that, I mean, because you can't wrap your mind around it. Or even cases with elderly victims, you know, just can't, you can't understand that, you know, that, you know, what type of person wants to victimize somebody that can't defend themselves, you know, and those are the hardest to, you know, maintain that professionalism and stay focused on the case because you really want to, you want to reach out. But, those are probably the most frustrating, you know, the cases though, I can't say that I got frustrated working the cases. You know, there are so many different factors and most homicide detectives or police officers for that matter will tell you, it's never the external factors. It's inside, you know, it's the politics inside the job. It's the, you know, and not many of them complain about the low pay because we're good with that. It's, you know, it's the thanklessness and not that you really want somebody to congratulate you. Thank you. We just want to leave you alone. You know, it's just, so, you know, those are the things that are most frustrating is because you know what you're doing and you know where your heart is. And maybe somebody that's working with you knows that, but there are so many people that just don't get it. You know, they think you're just out being whatever, you know, your personality is different. You know, you come off as cocky or arrogant. You know, you got to be. I mean, you're chasing people with guns. I mean, I couldn't imagine a meek homicide detective, you know.
Oh, my God, can you imagine?
So you, and that, and the guys that you work with are exactly the same. So you don't get along. So it's pretty isolating. But the frustration comes from, you know, the inner politics and personal relationships, but the job isn't frustrating at all.
Yeah.
At least for me, it wasn't.
So when you've obviously sat in the room with some really, really bad guys and probably mm-hmm. women too. I'm sure you've come across a few sociopaths in your time. I mean, what is it like sitting in front of these, like the true, you know, let's excuse the, not excuse, but let's not think about like the crimes of passion, mm-hmm. but like the really true, like cold blooded sociopath, you know, killer. What can you see it in their eyes? I mean, can, oh, that's really a thing.
It's really creepy. Actually, the old detectives always tell you when you go in as a rookie, you're going to know your suspect when you meet him, because you do. I mean, you can just see it. It just oozes out of them. But the ones that are just really crazy and depraved, it's just hard to keep a straight face. But, you know, when you leave and whoever you're with, whatever detective, you got a guy, this dude is Satan, because they're pretty bad people.
Yeah.
The object, though, is to somehow, get beyond that, and just kind of jump over it and go to the person, because there's something about them that's human, and it's just tapping into that area that I think the difficult part is being able to do that.
Yeah.
But once you get that done, you're there.
Sounds like you wear many hats as a detective, somewhat psychologist, just all kinds of things.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't know. I don't know if there's any other work that's as fascinating,
I don't think so.
And police work, I worked a couple different things, narcotics, robbery, burglary, but sex crimes and homicide, those are really passionate human crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires such a personal connection and investment. And, I think that's what I liked about work in those cases. And, I applaud all the advances in forensics, but now you gotta be a police to make that happen.
Sure.
It's just a connection.
Yeah, definitely. I know everybody kind of wants to get all that. I guess maybe it's the OJ case that brought it out, but it's like everybody's like, well, where's the DNA? There's not always that.
Hey guys. I'm Tyler.
And I'm Maya.
And we are Murder on the Mind.
Murder on the Mind.
We're interested in the scary, mysterious, and horrific things that happen in everyday life.
Ooh. From serial killers to mysteries and even a good old spooky ghost story. We talk about all things creepy all the time.
Weekly, and you can catch us on iTunes or wherever else you get your fine podcasts. Check us out.
Murder on the Mind.
Murder on the Mind.
So, Rod, in your 20s, tragedy struck again when your brother was convicted of murder. And I think he was sentenced to life in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about what happened and how that impacted you?
Yeah, I can give you some basics of it.
Please.
Get real deep into it because I don't really understand the dynamics of it. But my brother, I had just gotten back from Japan. I think I was in the military from a deployment. And my brother came to me and told me, just kill someone. And he was covered in blood, and he it was one of those whole drug things, whatever. But I took him to the police, and they took him away, and he was convicted. I didn't stick around for the trial. I didn't do any of that stuff. And it was probably 15 years before I actually talked to him again, because I just didn't want to. And the effect that it had was the fact that it was just he and I. And, my brother had seen what we went through growing up, and I just couldn't get past that. So. Ironically, it was probably easier for me to forgive the guy who killed my mother than my brother, because my brother actually owed me something, and so, we've gotten beyond that, and, we have a very good relationship now.
Good.
But and on the flip side of that, it definitely made me a better detective. I could always look back, my brother was a regular guy, riding bikes, or doing whatever we did, Ataris and, stuff like that. But when I talk to someone who has committed the same type of crime now, I don't automatically look at this mm-hmm. person and say, they're a monster. And they very well may be,
mm-hmm.
but I do have the ability to know that there's something in them that, at some point they weren't.
So, right.
So it's kind of easy to kind of extrapolate the good from them, I guess, if hadn't I had that experience. So,
interesting dichotomy, obviously. Just, you've spent your whole career putting the quote unquote, the bad guy away. And here you find yourself with such a close family member who's found himself on the wrong side of the law.
Yeah.
So I just can't imagine how that was for you? I'm glad to hear you all, you have a relationship today. Yeah. That must have been hard.
Yeah, I think when you look at crime, especially violent crime and murder, I don't think it's a personal thing when it comes to someone committing a crime that you should be looking at. I think it's a personal thing for the victim and the survivors and the people working it. That's where the passion should come. I don't know that you should look at the person who did it as the human element, mm-hmm. because, you know, there's obviously at some point where they get to their point where they do whatever. Well, we can deal with that, you know, and go to prison forever. But you have to maintain that whole human side when you deal with the other people. So it's a difficult balance in that.
Yeah, I can imagine. What was one of your most memorable cases and why?
It was a domestic violence case, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. There was a young lady, and her boyfriend was quite a bit older than her, and he beat her, I mean, senselessly. He locked her inside the house when he went to work, and he came home one day, and it's Louisiana, right? So she cooks for him, feeds him some red beans and rice, and he falls asleep on the couch, and she walks up and shot him in the back of the head. And
oh, wow, so she shot him.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
He took him out, and it was actually my first homicide, so I guess that's probably why I remember it so much. But, you know, there was so much with all the guys that were working with me and my training officers. They're telling me that, you know, I know this is a suicide because she tried to stage the scene. But she just looked at me and started crying, you know. And so, I don't know, it just kind of stuck in my head because, you know, she was clearly a victim. But,
sure.
She went to prison, but she didn't get life. I think she got 10 or 15 years, but... I think it's cases like that, or the pregnant girl. She was, you know, 5 months pregnant and she was murdered. I mean, it's cases like that just kind of, you know, stick with you.
That one was tough to watch. Ended up on one of the episodes. Yeah. That was extremely so cold-blooded.
Oh, yeah.
But going back to the domestic violence, that's got to be hard for you because you look at her, she's obviously a victim and she just had enough. And yeah, she did some things. She staged the scene and all that, but you can't help but feel for her and go, if that were my sister, I'd still love her and go, you probably saved your own life by doing that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So that's probably tough for you.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that's another way detectives can succeed is, you know, you got to kind of realize that you gather all the evidence, facts, and information and give it to the courts. I mean, but when you start to get, you know, I want this person to go to jail or I don't want, that's where you have a problem. Yeah. So, yeah, I was able, thank God, to just do it and just cut it off, you know, because you could do that.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And then I'm sure you've been called in, you know, as a witness on some of these trials. And, you know, when you're doing your work, are you probably not because you're just so laser focused on what you're doing and getting justice. But are you ever cognizant of the fact that this could end up in a jury trial and I've got to watch my P's and Q's and do this investigation right because you don't want the defense to be able to attack the credibility or do you just not get that far?
No, you don't. But I've worked with people that did and it kind of skews their investigations, you know.
I can imagine.
You know, I think the closest I ever get to it, you know, are the major things like is this person drunk or under the influence of drugs or alcohol when I advise them of their rights, you know, just maintaining their, you know, constitutional rights, but all the other stuff, not really. And it was interesting for me. I rarely prepared for trials, you know, like, I don't read reports and stuff because it's in my mind. It's right in the front of my mind, but obviously dates and times and stuff. But I think when you do that, it's kind of, you're kind of trying to present it for, and I think that was another thing that worked for me because I really didn't care what everybody else thought. You know?
You're trying to get justice.
Yeah.
You're not really worried about, you know, the defense attorney and that. Yeah. That's all like you probably put it on a shelf at that point. Yeah. My job is done.
Yeah.
For the most part, I'm moving on.
Yeah. And then after a few cases, you know, a few years, it doesn't really work like that because most defense attorneys, they know you and they know your reputation and they know what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. Yeah. But when you're going to have a hard time, that's anything in life. You try to see what somebody else is going to.
Oh, yeah.
Prove a thing. So, no, I never really gave that a whole lot of thought. And I guess you just actively recognize that. I think that's probably one of the things that worked a lot for me.
Yeah. Obviously, I would imagine one of the toughest parts of your job is delivering the news to these families. I mean, it's something like, you know, a person like me who doesn't do the work you do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I cannot watch those scenes without shedding a tear.
Yeah,
and so.
Yeah.
I mean, have you ever become visibly, I'm sorry, emotional when you've delivered the news or you're just able to?
Yeah. I just do it. And later, sometimes I do, you know, sometimes, you know, after I get somebody in jail,
yeah.
You know, you kind of feel those emotions when everything is over. Sure. You know, thank God. You know, because, yeah, because, you know, operating emotionally wouldn't work. But yeah, I think, you know, after a trial, you know, like, yeah, you know, stick around to say anything to the family because you would be emotional.
Definitely.
You know, but no, delivering the news is, I think I hated it. I mean, more than anything on earth, but it kind of motivates you because you are responsible to that person now.
Yeah.
And their reaction, which you think you can predict, you can't, and, mm-hmm, you know, and it kind of pushes you because you, at that point, you owe them, you know, and it's, you know, I don't know that you go back or, and say, you know, I didn't do it, you know, so, you know, you stand out weeks trying to solve this case. So.
Yeah. It sounds like you just from watching the show, it looks like you take a pretty direct approach and just, yeah, be honest. Like you, yeah, you know, you owe it to them, I guess, oh, you know, and yeah, you're just honest. Yeah, you just tell, yeah, them what it is.
Yeah. I don't believe in that. You know, this person's expired, they're deceased or they died and now, yeah, they were murdered. And, you know, you want to stay focused. I think that actually gives the family or the survivor some confidence in you, you know, yeah, because, you know, they know you're not going to bullshit them, trying to make them feel better. You know, yeah, they know you're going to do what you got to do and gets you a lot further than trying to be empathetic. You know, we had pastors on patrol or clergy members or chaplains that we would, you know, sometimes bring along to comfort them. But, you know, my job was to go find out who did it. And I wanted them to know that. I want to convey that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah, I don't know. I kind of didn't like to see, you know, police officers or detectives that got emotionally involved because, mm-hmm, to me, it was an excuse. you know, you want to build a rapport so they'll like you more, you know?
Yeah. And it's, yeah, it's, I mean, it's, yeah, I don't know. I'm not a homicide detective, yeah, and all that, you know, but it's not your tragedy. It's,
yeah,
theirs.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
it probably would be kind of strange, yeah, to, yeah, see you getting, yeah, emotional, yeah, in front, yeah, of them when it's like, that's, yeah, that's their tragedy.
Yeah. Or, you know, I don't want someone to say, oh, he tried really hard. I don't need that. I want them to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So something I'm really curious about is, you know, like I said earlier, besides crimes of passion, what do you think makes a person turn into a murderer? Is it nature? Is it nurture? Is it a combination?
Yeah, I think it's everybody tough. Has that capacity. I think it's innate. I think people have a primal instinct, and I think people are capable. Everybody's capable of killing because you have some instances you have to kill to survive, you know, or protect someone. I think, though, when people go too far, it's just somebody that didn't have any control over that at all. You know, at some point they lose it. It's like they can't control their emotions. And yeah, that's why, you know, murder is always a passionate crime. Unless, of course, it's a contract killer or, you know, a psychopath, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, serial killer. But for the most part, it's somebody lost control. And I think for that reason, working murders is a lot easier than working robberies, you know, because I worked robbery. And I had a guy that I worked with. He said, you know, somebody robs a convenience store because they're open. Yeah, that's it. That's all it takes, right? But to kill somebody, they had to do something or, yeah, felt like someone did something to them. So it kind of narrows down that pool. Now,
right,
obviously, there are the people out there that, but even then, you know, hired killer, whoever hired him has some sort of connection to the victim.
Or, right.
You know, so everything short of a psychopath, it's some sort of connection.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's all these infamous, you know, cases, and some of them have not been solved. Have you ever thought about if you could solve one infamous murder case that's been unsolved, is there one that stands out for you that you would love to solve?
Yeah. The OJ case.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up because, I mean, I don't care what anybody says. That case will fascinate me all day long because it's so one of my questions actually is, did OJ do it? And do you think he had an accomplice if you think he did it?
I think OJ did it. I don't know that he had an accomplice. Maybe somebody after the fact, you know, or something. But if it wasn't OJ, it was somebody that had the same passion and emotion for the victim that he did.
Mm-hmm.
You can probably narrow that down to OJ.
I was just going to say, you could probably narrow it down to OJ, right?
Yeah, you know, and I certainly don't want to seem as if, though, I can pass judgment on because I don't know anything.
Sure.
I didn't work the case.
Sure.
But there are certain foundations that are laid in every murder investigation. And, you know, I don't know. I think it's a failure on so many different levels. So.
I mean, there has to be a failure on so many different levels when it's unsolved, right?
Yeah,
it's, you know, you've got families grieving and they don't have the answers that they need. So. Definitely. But gosh, that was like definitely the crime of the century.
Yeah.
What stands out to you when you know you're sitting in front of a cold-blooded killer? I mean, I know you said you can kind of see it in their eyes, but what stands out to you? I mean, do they really just lack empathy? I mean, are they really like as subhuman as we think they are?
Yeah, they are. Yeah. But I think the challenge though for me was to get in there and try to get inside their, you know, inside their head, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term, or in that space. You know, it's always, yeah, I took this class, this hostage negotiations class, and they say that everybody has a trigger or some sort of hook that you can use to find out what's important to them, and the floodgates open. And it's absolutely true. Mm. You know, so always look for that, you know, and it's not as obvious as you may think. Telling somebody they're going to prison for the rest of their life usually doesn't work. You know, if they have conditions outside that are just as bad. But there's something, you know, maybe it's, you know, your dog's going to go to a shelter, you know.
Yeah.
Some people don't care about their mom, you know.
Yeah, it's true, but your dog.
Yeah, stereo you just put in your car. So, you know, it's just, it could be something really small. It's just finding that thing that, so looking for that in somebody that's so cold and withdrawn, it's, there's something.
Yeah, you know, it's just, that's interesting. Ugh, it's creepy because anytime I see pictures of these sociopaths, you know, you look them up online, I'm always looking at their eyes going, can I see it? And I always think I can, but maybe it's because I already know, but it's creepy looking at somebody like Ted Bundy. And, I mean, honestly, even, you know, OJ at times, I look at him and I go, I don't know. I think maybe I can see something there. But again, like you said, we don't know. So the TV show Murder Chose Me on Investigation Discovery, I'm a huge fan. Love the show. How'd this opportunity come about?
Working a case, I worked a murder case, pregnant girl. She's 19 when she got killed. And the production company, Jupiter Entertainment, had another show, Fatal Attraction, and they interviewed me for that. And they came back and interviewed me for another. And before you know it, they were, hey, you want a show?
Why not?
So it... I think it's a good thing. I mean, it's a good way to reach people, and I think it's spiritual. Actually, I think that God's plan was for me to be able to tell everybody that, and you know, it works. I mean, people connect on levels that you'd never imagine, and so
worked. Yeah, you definitely got a platform now, it's great. It's a great network. Yeah. I mean, gosh, it's, I don't know when it started gaining its popularity, but when the opportunity came about to talk to you, the first question somebody asked me was, well, do you watch ID? And I'm like, do I watch ID? Yeah. I mean, you've got some good shows.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it's a great network. I mean, they actually listen to what you got to say, you know, and they try to stay true to it. And, it worked out. I mean, they're, you know, the thing I always say is that, you know, it's kind of amazing for somebody from Bangladesh to mourn with somebody from Shreveport. It just brings the world closer, and people kind of actually reach out and feel things that they would have otherwise not known. So, it works.
Very cool. Tell me a little bit about the show. I mean, obviously I've watched it, but so these are cases that are from your past, your career.
Yeah. These are all the homicide cases that I worked as a homicide detective. I host and narrate the show, and there's an actor, John Nicholson, who plays me in the reenactment portion of it. And I'll tell part of the story and he'll reenact, and then I'll tell the other part. It's a first person, so that's what's kind of cool about it. And it's just a great formula.
Definitely.
And,
We were talking about in the beginning. I think for me, what works is, you know, like we said, the true crime TV can get a little cheesy. Because whenever I watch a true crime show that's a little cheesy, it distracts me from the real seriousness of the story. We're talking about murder. When I watch Murder Chose Me, it's not cheesy. Yeah. And so it doesn't distract me. And I get really deep into the story, and I can feel it, you know, on a human emotional level. But I also think they do a really good job. Like I said, you know, the actor who plays you, when you're sitting there talking, you know, at the table about a case, and it just cuts to him actually acting out that. Yeah. It just is such a seamless transition. It was a great, great actor to play you.
Yeah. He and I, we have similar personalities, so we kind of hit it off.
How has being on TV changed your life? You're a big TV star now.
it has, I guess, but I kind of don't get into it. You know? I mean, being a police officer for so long, is kind of you're always suspicious of everybody. You know, people at the grocery store that come up behind you, think you're going to shoot them, or they're going to shoot you. But it changes, I guess. It changes a lot. But probably benefits my kids more than me, you know, because they like that kind of stuff. But I don't know. I haven't really changed a whole lot about my routine. And I went back to work at the DA's office, so I didn't really have a chance to get into that.
Sure. Get wrapped up.
Yeah.
So you talked about your daughters. I saw, did you author a book called Things My Daughter Should Know? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
So what prompted you to write that book?
Well, you know, I got to a point in life where, you know, I guess maybe because of my work, I had all these failed relationships. And, you know, I have, my daughter was growing into a young lady at that time. And I just wanted to tell her what she could look forward to. Or not, you know, and what to expect out of relationships, and maybe give her the knowledge and the information that any father would want to give his daughter, you know, because I truly believe that a woman gets the unfiltered truth from her father, you know.
I believe that.
Yeah, you know, so it was pretty raw. It's just pretty much, hey, don't do this, do that. Don't do this, do that.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of bargaining. There's not a lot of, you know, and it's pretty raw about what happens in certain relationships that don't go right, you know, when guys lie, when guys are possessive, controlling, and all that stuff. So you pick up all that stuff in your career and your failed relationships. You put it all together, and you want your children to do better.
So it's true.
Yeah, so you put it out there.
And I think you're right. You know, I think I can't brush every mom with a broad stroke, but I know personally speaking, you know, I do tend to sugarcoat, and I rely on my husband to give it to them real. And I think we're serving them so much more by just giving, like you said, just be blunt about it, because I think that they'll be released off into the world in their adulthood being better off for it.
Hearing
those things. And oh my gosh, I can't imagine the things a homicide detective would tell.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
they're getting everything.
I mean, my daughter could bring Gandhi home and I'd find a problem with them, you know? So it's just the way it is.
It's so funny. I was talking to Anna before you got here, and I only knew you before this from watching the show. I said, man, he is intimidating. And I said, where was he? Like, I need a friend like you for when my son was a teenager to just, I just need to call in reinforcements. Like, my son's just being a total, teenage a-hole. I need to call Rod Demery in and go, all right, sit down in front of him. Cut through the BS.
Unfortunately, my son gets that. he gets that a lot.
What's next for you personally and professionally?
I started a while back in a master's program in theology. I want to finish it because I want to teach social sciences, criminal justice, sociology, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think that's probably what I'm going to do.
Very cool. Yeah, gosh, so, I mean, as if everything you've already done just isn't enough.
Yeah.
You're an overachiever.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. I think it's just, I've been blessed. It's kind of, can't really just take it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's just, very neat. So I have a very serious question for you, Rod. Given all the experience you have, do you think you could commit the perfect murder?
Oh, yeah.
I'm so glad you're honest.
Oh, absolutely. Somebody else asked me that, and I said, you know, if you work at Burger King, you can make a good Whopper, right?
That's true.
Yeah.
So you could commit the perfect murder. I always have these conversations with my friends who are like true crime obsessed, and I think I have it in my head how I might.
There's one caveat. Everybody does.
Probably. So, you're right. Like, they go into it thinking, I'm going to get away with this.
They're
right?
So smart, right?
Yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to cover up this way. And it's interesting. Well, I just really appreciate you taking the time with me.
You.
You're really fascinating, impressive guy.
Thank you.
It's really cool that you're able to transition into, you know, starring in the show because, you know, homicide detective, I mean, nothing against you because you got a great personality, but I don't know if you guys are known for your
having
most shining personality, and you do. You're a really dynamic guy,
and
I enjoy the show
that.
Because of it. So
I appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
I want to say a few quick thank yous to some people who made this episode possible. Thank you so much to Jason Galbraith for making sure the sound quality of this episode is top notch. This was my first in-person interview, and Jason took the stress of worrying about the audio quality off my shoulders. Jason is a podcast host himself, and I highly suggest you check out his shows. He hosts the Evening Radio podcast and the Difference Between Us podcast. Please check out both of his shows and leave them both a 5-star rating and review if you're so inclined. Thank you also to my awesome audio editor and show producer, John Buchanis of Audio Editing Solutions. John actually connected Jason and me, and I can't thank him enough for that. John is a critical part of the Murderish podcast, as he makes all of the necessary edits, he adjusts sound quality to make it a pleasant listening experience for all of you, he adds all the music, and does so much more. If you need a top-notch audio editor for your project or podcast, check out audioeditingsolutions.com. You won't regret it. Last but certainly not least, I want to thank Rod Demery for taking time to talk to me. Rod is a very sharp yet down-to-earth guy who I found to be so open about his life and his experiences. There are so many fascinating dynamics about Rod and his life. It's no wonder Hollywood came knocking and offered him a TV show. Season 2 of Murder Chose Me on Investigation Discovery airs on April 4th. Stop what you're doing right now and put this show in your queue. It's a must-see for true crime junkies. As always, you guys, thank you so much for listening to Murderish. We've come a long way together, and there's so much more to do. I'm excited about the future of the show and taking all of you along for the ride. Until next time, stay safe. I look forward to seeing you all again soon. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating and review. And don't be shy. Tell a friend. The word of mouth is powerful. You can follow the podcast on social media, on Twitter at Murderish Pod, and on Facebook at Murderish Podcast. I have a closed group set up for us to discuss all things murderish. If you'd like to take your support for the podcast a step further, you can visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/murderish. If you choose to become a patron, you'll get some extra perks in exchange. Again, that's patreon.com/murderish. Murderish merchandise is also available at 2 online stores. Links to the online stores are available in show notes and in the About section of the Murderish Podcast Facebook group. Thank you so much for listening and for your support. And remember, listening to this podcast doesn't make you a murderer. It just means you're murder-ish.
Yeah, go ahead and say a few things.
Okay. Murderish.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. By the way, I have a hat for you, which is really funny. Oh, I just have to pull this out now because my husband was dying. He's all, do you really think a homicide detective's going to wear a hat that says,
I want you to have it.
You
don't definitely
have to wear it, but hey. I just want to give you a little swag because.
I'm going to wear it, actually.
I appreciate that. But he's like, do you really think he's going to wear it?
Yeah, I like it.
You know what it is? It's like, murderish to me is like a... Like, I'm not a murderer. I'm just murder-ish. You're true crime obsessed. Yeah. You're a true crime junkie. It's an adjective.
Oh, man. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Vacuum podcast is the best.
No, it's not a vacuum podcast. It's a murder-ish podcast.
Is that, what is murder-ish podcast?
It's the best podcast in the world. Do you like murder-ish podcast?
Murder-ish podcast. Best in the whole place.
Yeah! That's what I think.
Hi, True Crime fans. I'm Erin.
And I'm Shay. We host All Crime, No Cattle, a conversational podcast which focuses on true crime stories from the Lone Star State.
We strive to bring you a balanced and well-researched story about Texas cases big and small.
We do the research so you don't have to.
We also end every episode with a good news story, just to remind everyone that real life isn't quite as depressing as true crime can make it out to be.
New episodes drop every Thursday, and you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. All Crime, No Cattle, because crime is bigger in Texas, y'all.
Hi, everyone. My name is Ben. I'm the host of Dark Histories Podcast. I'm a huge fan of an unsolved mystery, true crime, and the fringe, strange, and out there aspects of our cultural history. Each episode of Dark Histories focuses on a different subject, from a peculiar poisoning in Victorian England to the role of vampires in fiction and folklore. You can find the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or head over to darkhistories.com for more subscription links and details about the show. I hope to have you join us soon.
Hi, I'm Natalie.
And I'm Paige. We're the hosts of The Murder Diaries.
We're a weekly victim-centered true crime podcast. Our goal is to always keep the victim's name and light alive in our coverage of missing, unsolved, and suspicious death cases.
New episodes are available every Thursday. Listen to The Murder Diaries wherever you get your podcasts.